Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling he would say,
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and my guest speaker, Sheikh Javid. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Greetings to you and very welcome.
Thank you very much for having me on. I am at your service.
Thank you very much for accepting offer to come to the studio and shed some light on the jurisprudential laws or Islamic laws according to fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. And we are actually dealing with some of these jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature according to fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Let me begin our episode with this question. What are the laws for aqiqa, right? And more specifically, I want to ask you if the meat is eaten by the parents of the very child that they have sacrificed, for example, or they have given out an aqiqa, is it okay for them to eat a part of that, for example, aqiqa, or not?
Right. Well, aqiqa is a sacrifice, okay, that is recommended to be carried out on the seventh day of the child's birth, whether a boy or a son. And there are certain conditions which are not mandatory, because the aqiqah itself is not mandatory. When it's something is not mandatory, the rules and the restrictions surrounding that
Are more flexible,
and they are not mandatory either. They are not obligatory.
What about the kind of sacrifice after 1 year, like the birth of a child?
Okay,
is it still called an aqiqa, or only it should be actually the, we are calling the sacrifice after the seventh day of the birthday of a child?
Well, it is still called aqiqa. If he has not given, if he has not sacrificed an animal on the seventh day, so it can be done at any time or
in the future. Right.
Whether you are, let's say, 1 year old, or when you are 20 years old or 30 years old.
Yes.
Aqiqah will have its impact, or it is sawab for the person who sacrifices an animal and distributes the meat.
Yes.
The thing is that you said that whether it's allowed for the parents to receive a portion of the meat and eat or consume it, of course it is discouraged. It is not haram, but it's better for the parents not to eat, for the grandparents also, not to eat the meat of the animal slaughtered by them with the intention of aqiqah, to bless the child.
Right.
Yes.
And what about the kind of animal that they can sacrifice? Is there any rule for that?
Okay.
Like whether it's a chicken or a a sheep?
It is not a chicken that should be slaughtered, okay? It's a lamb, okay, that's healthy. For example, if there is, let's say, a lamb which is 2 years old and it has horns, okay?
Right.
Horns. The horns should not be broken.
Oh.
the lamb itself should be healthy. If one of its legs is broken and the horn is broken, it's discouraged.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it should be a perfect, healthy animal that you slaughter.
Only a lamb is referred to as the aqiqah? Oh,
it can be a cow, it can be a camel.
Yeah.
Okay, but people generally afford the lamb to sacrifice it.
But it's not certainly a chicken.
Yeah, it's not a chicken, of course.
I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Shabit. Let's take a short break and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. Don't go away.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
Welcome back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, my guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, we know that sometimes when people get married, actually there is a period, like a gap in between their engagement and their marriage, right?
Right.
And my question is related to that gap, basically, between the engagement and the marriage. We know that the consent or agreement of the husband is necessary for the wife, usually in the course of their lifetime.
Right.
But what happens to that small period or gap that we call the engagement period? They are engaged, the couple is engaged, but they are not married yet. So They are not married yet. They are engaged.
Do you mean that the marriage contract has not been solemnized?
Well, I mean, like, they have been engaged by giving out, for example, giving each other a ring. And they are officially registered as being engaged.
Okay.
Right? So whether it is the registered office or somewhere else, or, for example, a religious scholar has pronounced the engagement formula for them, so sort of like marriage formula.
Well, to be honest, there's no such thing as engagement without, you know, without marriage contract. When a man is engaged,
yes,
people often understand that okay, there's no nikah between them, and they are still no mahram to each other. They are unrelated to each other.
Yes,
engagement doesn't mean that they can sit together, laugh, and start joking, touching each other. No, because there's no nikah. If there's no nikah, then they are still non-mahram to each other, and they should stay away from each other. They should not treat each other in the same way as couples or husbands and wives do that, treat each other. So they are non-mahram. But if a marriage formula has been recited,
yes,
and the marriage has been solemnized, even though consummation of the marriage has not taken place,
right,
they are mahram to each other. So all boundaries or limits are removed when the nikah is conducted.
Doesn't it depend on whether they are living together or not? Cohabiting?
That's I want to talk about mahramiyya, okay, which is established by nikah.
Right.
But when it comes to permission of, let's say, going out, doing certain things, of course, as long as the husband does not provide his wife with food, clothing, and other regular expenses, and it's the father indeed, it's the father,
right,
so the husband does not have the right to forbid his wife from going out of her father's house, because he does not provide his wife with food, clothing, other expenses. Okay, she is still in her father's house.
Right.
So it is her father who should allow him or allow her or permit her to go out or not to go out.
I see.
Yes. the husband in that case has no authority.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh. Let's take a short break and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/EM. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah, don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Welcome back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature according to fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini. Sheikh Javid, what is the Islamic law regarding, the kind of prayer people are offering while they are doing so, or while they are saying their prayer, there is the sound of music in the surrounding?
Well, it is basically, it's not good to offer prayers in such places where music is being played and where one gets easily distracted. Okay, so what is not good is distraction, which
right.
takes place when one listens, when one hears music.
Right.
You, the person, the duty-bound person who prays,
mm-hmm.
does not listen to music intentionally.
Yes.
But it is something that, okay, comes to his ear and he hears the sound of the music. He's not to blame. But if there's no other place to offer his prayer, it's okay to pray in that very place. For example, someone goes to a wedding hall, and the wedding hall has a special place dedicated for people who want to pray.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the same is the case with some airports. There are, for example, there is a special room for people who wants to pray.
Yes.
And of course, music is being played at the airport or at railway station or maybe wedding hall, and people cannot go out of the wedding hall or other places. And even if they go out, they don't find a place to offer their prayers.
Mm-hmm.
So music is there, so it is still permissible to offer one's prayer in that room or in that place.
Oh, okay. What about the situation where there is a non-mahram, somebody who's not related to you by marriage, actually?
Yes.
Is this kind of prayer that we are offering still valid? I mean, I'm talking about, for example, the women who are offering the prayer, but there is a non-mahram around in that very room, for example.
Of course, it is permissible. There's nothing wrong with that. When there's no other room for a lady, for a woman to offer her prayers, she is allowed to offer her prayers in that room or place where there is a non-mahram.
Right.
Okay. We do see a lot of ladies, especially those going to Atabat, to the holy sites in Najaf, Karbala, and Mashhad, they offer their prayers in the presence of lots of non-mahram people, okay?
Yes.
And there's nothing wrong with that.
I see. And what about the kind of hijab or covering that women should wear while offering their prayer? Should they go in full hijab, right? Let me define the hijab that I'm talking about. Like, for example, is chador the kind of piece of cloth that Muslim women usually wear, like covering from head to toe? Is that necessary or no? Just the kind of covering that those parts which are obligatory to be covered, enough?
Well, a particular type of hijab or clothing,
yes.
is not recommended by Islam. Okay, Islam, for example, does not tell you what kind of hijab or what kind of dress you should wear. Okay, it depends on common sense and common understanding.
Right.
Okay, chador, in my opinion, is a perfect hijab. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But what is necessary according to Islam is to cover for a woman. What is necessary is to cover her hair, neck, and then legs, and also feet if there are non-mahram people around the woman.
Right.
Otherwise, it's not necessary to cover the feet when there's no non-mahram. And of course, it's not necessary to cover the face. It's not necessary to cover the hands up to the wrists.
Yes.
But other parts of the body must be covered.
Right.
Irrespective of whether there is any non-mahram around you, around a woman or not. Even if there's no one around the woman, she must still cover all parts of her body except the face and the hands up to the wrist.
And the color is not important.
The color is not important.
Thank you very much, Sheikh. That was Sheikh Javid, my guest speaker, talking with me in the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, where we talked about some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature according to fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. From me, Muhammad Jawad, the host of this program, we bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Chased by wolves, followed by a hawk, on the battlefield you took your final walk. It took my breath when you said goodbye, but then again, heroes never die. Your final words were stay the course. Trust in God, the everlasting source. Don't give in to the enemy's plots. Resist with faith, go against the odds. Your way I follow, oh my hero. Unbreakable soul, unstoppable power. Until the last breath, you never surrender. Unshakable faith, unwavering sacrifice. Make you the hero we'll remember forever. Your blood was spilled, but it nourished my roots. I then became a tree with many. Our love, courage, and resolve. You've made me a soldier, so you I salute. Your way I follow, oh my hero. Unbreakable soul, unstoppable power, until the last breath you never surrender. Unshakable faith, unwavering sacrifice, make you the hero we'll remember forever.
Have a very good time. This is Iran Radio, and here are some interesting facts about Islam. In 10th century Cordoba, an Umayyad Islamic dynasty city in Spain with over 70 libraries, the palace library alone had over 60,000 volumes, all written by hand. At the time, the best Latin library in Europe had only 600 parchment books. While the Chinese invested paper sometime before the 2nd century BC, Muslims were the first to mass-produce paper on an intercontinental scale, developing a culture dependent on its abundance. As the price of paper dropped, literacy rose and booksellers and libraries became integral parts of every Muslim city. Like Judaism and Christianity, Islam originated in the Middle East. And here's what's awaiting you on your radio station. Don't miss a beat. Up next is Let's Recite the Holy Quran. Mr. Habibullah Fasihzadeh will guide us. In this program, we teach eloquent recitation of the Quran at level 2. We also express tajweed points in the manner of confrontation or compare and match and apply them to the verses of the final surahs of the Holy Quran. A beautiful opportunity for reflection indeed. Then enjoy another segment from our radio productions. We've created a range of fascinating audio pieces for your listening pleasure. Coming up, we will have Let's Recite the Quran. Stay tuned.
Iqra bismi rabbika alladhi khalaq.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Ya ayyuhal muzammil قم الليل إلا قليلا نصفه
أو انقص منه قليلا أو زد عليه ورتل القرآن ترتيلا
فدعوتك ربي بقرآني جنبني حراني.
Let's recite the Quran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. May the peace and blessings of Allah be upon the soul of Prophet Muhammad and his purified progeny. Dear audience, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another episode of the program, Let's Recite the Quran, coming to you from the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. I'm your host Mahdi, and as always, we are joined by Quran expert, dear brother Muhammad. Assalamu alaikum, brother.
Assalamu alaikum, Brother Mahdi. Thank you for having me. And assalamu alaikum to all the dear listeners of this program. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you, brother. Well, dear audience, as you may know, the program Let's Recite the Quran consists of several Quranic parts. First, Brother Muhammad is going to talk about the music or the musical miracle of the Noble Quran. Then, we all are going to listen to a recitation by a famous reciter of the Noble Quran, and at the end, Brother Muhammad is going to analyze that recitation from different aspects. Stay tuned. Well, in the first part of the program, Let's Recite the Quran. As always, we are going to talk about the miraculous music of the Noble Quran. Brother Muhammad, up to now we have talked about a lot of aspects of the music of the Noble Quran. The rhymes, the way the sounds try to convey the meanings, and a lot of other aspects. Let's continue our discussion, brother.
Sure. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. We gave some examples of in the Quran where the words and the letters, they help us better understand the meaning, and we can actually visualize the meanings of the verses just by pronouncing those letters and uttering those words. Another example I'd like to give today of this issue is in verse 50 to 51 of Surah Al-Muddathir. كأنهم حمر مستنفرة فرت من قسورة. Allah is talking about what is the matter with some people that they turn away from admonition, from tadhkirah, when someone is preaching them to be pious, to fear Allah, to believe, to refrain from committing sins, to do good. What is it with some people that it's as if they are donkeys, frightened donkeys, who are running away from a lion, from a hunting lion? The word qaswara is rarely used, which means hunter or lion, okay? And this strange word is used to describe a strange and wonderful scene of a lion chasing a donkey. Whenever you see documentaries about animals and how, you know, when you see the scene of a lion or a cheetah chasing its prey,
yes,
okay, it's very like it catches your attention and you keep watching it and it's like it's
rare actually. It's
interesting, yeah, it's rare and it's like, and Allah uses the word qaswara, and by the way, these two words rhyme. كأنهم حمر مستنفرة فرت من قسورة. It's as if the lion is chasing the donkey, because both words, they have the same rhyme. It's like they're coming right after one another.
Thank you, Brother Muhammad. Dear audience of IRIB English Radio, we'll be right back after a short break. Stay tuned. Dear audience of IRIB English Radio, in the second segment of the program, Let's Recite the Quran, we all are going to listen to the recitation of verses 1 to 7 of Surah Al-Infitar, recited by Sheikh Abdul Mun'im Tuqi. Dear audience, let's enjoy it.
Thank you. ربك فسواك فسواك فعدلك فعدلك في أي صورة ما شاء ركبك صدق الله العظيم.
Dear brothers and sisters in Islam, you're still listening to the program Let's Recite the Quran, and what you just listened to was recitation of verses 1 to 8 of Surah Al-Infitar, recited by Sheikh Abdul Mun'im At-Tukhi. Now, Brother Muhammad, let's talk about this beautiful recitation.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. This was a very enjoyable recitation to listen to.
Surely it was.
And the thing is that the Egyptian reciters, they know exactly how to recite the words of the Quran in such a way that it conveys the meaning perfectly. And the maqamat that they choose, the intonation, the tone, the pitch, everything. For example, verse 6, the way that Sheikh At-Tukhi, he read, yeah, like he... The Ya Ayyuhal Insan is Allah is trying to say, oh, you human being. Ya is a word that is used to catch attention, yes, to draw attention. The way that he says Ya, he plays with the maqam. Ya. Like he wants to catch the attention of the human, yes, being. Ya Ayyuhal Insan. Ya Ayyuhal Insan, ma gharraka bi rabbikal kareem. And on the word Kareem, he has a rising intonation because it's a question.
Mm-hmm.
What has made you arrogant, or what has seduced thee from thy Lord? This is what Yusuf Ali has said.
But my Lord, who is Kareem, actually.
Yeah, the most beneficent, the majestic. What has made you arrogant, proud, that you don't listen to your Lord? Alladhi khalaqaka fasawwaka fa'adalak. When he repeats the verse, Ya ayyuhal insan, Almat nafsum ma qaddamat wa akharat, Ya ayyuhal insan ma gharraka bi rabbikal kareem. The way that he
pronounces
the word
kareem
is like you could feel this majesty,
yeah,
of Allah.
The rahmah,
everything.
Karama, yeah.
The way that he pronounces it, he pronounces it very beautifully.
Yes.
You know? Bi rabbika al-kareem, like this. Kareem. Just the kareem, just the ya'ul mat of the kareem, he changes his voice. He makes his voice very gentle.
Yes.
And very delicate.
And it is effective.
Yeah. And one thing about this surah is that we have a lot of ta sakinas. We're going to talk about the tajweed now.
Good idea.
The ta sakinas have to be pronounced correctly and audibly.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So if you can't hear the ta sakina, it means that you are not pronouncing the ta correctly. For example, if you say, إِذَا السَّمَاءُ فَطَرَتْ وَإِذَا الْكَوَاكِبُ تَثَرَتْ. Did you hear the ta?
No.
إِذَا السَّمَاءُ فَطَرَتْ وَإِذَا الْكَوَاكِبُ تَثَرَتْ.
Pronouncing it without qalqala
without
is qalqala, difficult.
Yeah, and without aspiration. If you say وَإِذَا الْكَوَاكِبُ تَثَرَتْ, that's incorrect.
Yeah.
This is what makes it difficult. And of course, sometimes the microphone can't detect this very subtle sound. Okay,
mm-hmm.
But whenever he recites in the low register, we could hear the taz very clearly, because whenever he stops on the last, the final word of the verse, for example, he says, "Alimat nafsum ma qaddamat wa akharat wa akharat." We hear
it is full of ta sound.
Yeah,
ta sound.
We have a lot of ta sounds at the beginning of this surah, and then from verse 6 onwards, we don't have the ta sakina. Kareem alladhi khalqaka fasawwaka fa'adalaka fi ayyi suratin ma sha'a rakkabak. And خَلَقَكَ فَسَوَّاكَ فَعَدَلَكَ.
And then the kaf is repeated now.
Yeah, the kaf is repeated. خَلَقَكَ فَسَوَّاكَ فَعَدَلَكَ. The خَلَقَكَ.
خَلَقَكَ.
We have a kha and a qaf. Both are letters of isti'la. They have to be pronounced with tafkhim.
And lam in between.
The lam should not be pronounced with tafkhim. So we use the shape of the lips to help us pronounce these two letters of tafkhim correctly. Kha, the mouth opens vertically. Le, the mouth opens horizontally.
Yes.
And qa, again, the mouth opens vertically.
Vertically.
Khalaqaka.
Khalaqaka.
Yes. And Sheikh Atoukhi, he read the Maddul Munfasils with four vowel counts. يَا أَيُّهَا الْإِنسَانُ مَا غَرَّكَ بِرَبِّكَ الْكَرِيمِ الَّذِي خَلَقَكَ فَسَوَّاكَ فَعَدَلَكَ فِي أَيِّ صُورَةٍ فِي أَيِّ. We have Maddul Munfasil. Maddul Munfasil, disjunct mad. It takes place whenever there is a long vowel followed by a hamza, with the hamza being in another word.
Yes.
If the hamza is in the same word,
we have maddul
muttasil, the conjunct mad. If it's if the long vowel and the hamza are in two different words, we would have maddul munfasil. Fi ayyi surah, the sad of surah has tafkhim
at a moderate level.
You have to make sure that it's pronounced like a sad and not a seen. If you say fi ayyi surah, surah, it's not a sad. Surah, surah,
surah,
surah, surah. Mm-hmm.
The root of the tongue should be raised.
Yeah, the root of the tongue is raised.
And it's important to know that the place of articulation of seen
and sad is the same. So if you say fi ayyi surah,
again, it is wrong.
Surah is incorrect. Some people think that you have to make a whistling sound when pronouncing sad. That's not true.
Mm-hmm.
Sad is just like seen, except it has tafkhim.
That is the raised root of the tongue.
And yes, the root of it. And also has itbaq, which is the back of the tongue is raised as well. It's both pharyngealized and velarized.
Thank you, Brother Muhammad, and thank you, dear audience of IRIB English Radio. That was the final part of the program, Let's Recite the Quran. If you have any comments, questions, or suggestions, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. And don't forget to visit our website, that is parstoday.com. Please click on the tab Call of Islam, and there you can listen to this program as well as other programs of this radio. Until next time, we'll leave you in Allah's care. Have a nice time and goodbye.
ذكر وموعظة ونور فيه شفاء للصدور وشفيعنا يوم النشور آياته تروي المدى وصفاته نبع الهدى نلقى الجنان بحبه لن تستقيم حياة هو القرآن والفرقان إليه تنصت الأكوان وفيه تعطر الآذان والقرآن ضياء يملأ الآفاق ونور يبعث الأشواق وفيه محاسن الأخلاق
with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we provide an in-depth analysis of Israel's criminal behaviour and the effort it puts into influencing international policymakers and global public opinion. In today's show, we'll be setting out the real reasons behind Israel's renewed interest in Somaliland. In our first report, Rajiv Ravichakra provides some historical context to the recent developments in the relationship between Somaliland and Israel.
When people mention Greater Israel, they usually mean the plan to colonize all of what the Zionists call Erez Yisrael. That is, all the land between the rivers Nile and Euphrates, and thus includes all of Palestine, Lebanon, Jordan, and parts of Syria, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, and Egypt. But it is increasingly recognized that the Greater Israel project has aims far beyond West Asia. This has been admitted by Netanyahu, who says he absolutely subscribed to the vision. He has even presented maps of the new Middle East, which include all of Saudi Arabia and Egypt, as well as Sudan. But plans are much further advanced than this suggests. Somaliland is one of the Zionists' targets. It's a country which the Zionist movement wants to turn into a military base, from which the Zionists and the UAE carve up Africa into easily manipulated resource-plundering zones. Crucially, it is also very close, around 150 nautical miles, to the coast of Yemen, where the Zionists seek to destroy the Ansar Allah government. Somaliland is a former British colony bordering Djibouti, Ethiopia, and Somalia that declared independence from Somalia in 1991 without receiving international recognition. Under international law, Somaliland is currently deemed an autonomous district of Somalia. In 1960, a time when Somaliland was briefly independent, Israel was one of the 35 countries to recognize its independence. Back in the 1990s, the self-styled president of the so-called Republic of Somaliland wrote to the Zionist regime, asking for help with overcoming the Islamist adversaries of the people of Somaliland. "My government needs the support and assistance of the State of Israel to defend our nascent state from the menace of pro-Islamist dark forces." In February 2010, Israeli Foreign Ministry spokesperson Yigael Palmore revealed that Netanyahu was prepared to recognize Somaliland again, though it did not happen at the time. The plans are now active again. In late 2024, reports emerged that Israel had secretly approached Somaliland with an offer to establish a military base on its territory in exchange for official recognition. Somaliland is reportedly willing to accept the Israeli base, provided that Israel recognizes Somaliland and invests in it. In October this year, the Zionist regime dispatched Miss Israel on a mission to supposedly save Somali children, claiming in manifest propaganda that they were providing aid and protection without requesting anything in return. The neighboring Sudanese government's view is that Somaliland now serves as a UAE military hub. Armored vehicles, weapons, and gear flow through, moving onward to Ethiopia and into Darfur, fueling the RSF and UAE-backed mercenaries. Somaliland is on fire, not despite, but because of the intervention of the Zionists and their UAE proxies.
As usual, I'm joined in the studio by David Miller, who's the UK's foremost scholarly critic of Israel and our resident expert. He's a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch and a senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyim University. Today's guest contributor is a good friend of the show. He's the political commentator, celebrated hip-hop artist, and regular correspondent for Double Down News. His name is Loki. Welcome to the show. David, the Zionist ambition for a greater Israel is much larger than many people think, isn't it?
Well, you saw in the film there, don't you, didn't you, the extent of Greater Israel in the original Zionist plans, which, of course, have been denied for many decades, but now everybody acknowledges that they're true, including, of course, Netanyahu. And then you saw the Netanyahu at the UN with his diagrams of the new Middle East, which, of course, extends way beyond the Greater Israel. But, of course, we see in Somaliland and in Sudan and, indeed, in Ethiopia, the extent of the attempts by the Zionists to get into Africa and to use Africa as a mechanism for military projection and also, of course, for resource extraction. So, yeah, of course, they are trying to move way beyond the question of a greater Israel in West Asia, into Africa, into East Asia, and even into Latin America as well.
Well, okay, I mean, how How far do you think the ambition for a greater Israel extends then?
I think it depends on the definition that you apply. Because if you're talking about infrastructurally speaking, then in this country, for example, the police hacks phones with the use of an Israeli intelligence company which has access to that information. You have Oracle managing the data for key government institutions, and that organization clearly has a commitment to Israel, works closely with the Israeli military, and has a leader who is the largest donor to the Israeli military in the history of the charity that manages those donations. So really it spreads across the world in different ways, and I would say it exists within the infrastructural arrangements of society, meaning access to data, access to information. If you've just had the former head of Israel's external intelligence agency saying they have exported manipulated equipment into all sorts of countries, then you're really talking about something quite different from what is sometimes depicted as a colonial settler movement specifically focused on Palestine. You are now talking about something that has established itself as a regional hegemon militarily, certainly, but now also this interesting role around the world of trying to dictate events, control information, and bully governments.
Are we looking to a worldwide hegemon then? I mean, we're talking about a regional one, but I mean, from what you're saying, it seems to be obviously considerably
wider. Well, what certainly is true is that the United States has around 1,000 military bases around the world. What we don't know is the extent to which the Israeli military either has access to those bases or a presence on those bases. It's certainly come alongside the US empire around the world, but we just don't know the extent of Israel's role in these places.
Sure. Well, David, I mean, how long has the Zionists' involvement in Somaliland been going on for?
Well, we saw in the film there, I mean, they were involved way back when Somaliland declared itself independent. 35 countries in the world recognised it back in 1960, and the Zionists were one of those. And then more recently, they've opened these new negotiations to create a base there alongside their vassal state, the UAE, so that they can use the Somaliland's territory as a means for power protection in the region of the Horn of Africa, including in Sudan and Ethiopia and other countries in the area. So it's they've been involved for a long time, but they've now got focused and renewed efforts to extend their ability to project power into Africa. But of course, let's remember that the other reason why they want to be on the Red Sea and Horn of Africa coast is because it's just across the water from Yemen and from Ansarallah. 140 miles is the closest distance from Somaliland to the port of Aden, and of course that's part of the agenda as well.
Yeah, so it's kind of a military strategic.
It's a military strategic in terms of West Asia and Yemen, but it's military strategic in a different way in terms of power projection into Africa, into Sudan, and indeed further afield across to West Africa.
Sure. Well, Loki, I mean, Somaliland, I mean, it's not recognised as a country, is it, by the international community? So, I mean, why do you think Israel's moving to recognise, is it? I mean, David was just alluding to the situation in terms of its proximity to Yemen. I mean, is it to do with Ansarallah and their ability to, you know, to strike back against Ansarallah or what?
Well, if you look at it historically, the UAE from 2017 has controlled the port there. It also has a military base there, which has been accused of aiding in different ways forces within Sudan and being a basis of operations. The UAE has a network of airfields and bases across the region. And you also have to remember that the port of the Somaliland is controlled by DP World. Now, DP World is headed by a UAE government official who emails have just been released, was discussing the use of smart shoes with Jeffrey Epstein, the now deceased, it appears, Israeli asset. So essentially Israel wants to establish a military presence in Somaliland. It may have already done that through the UAE. That's probably the case. The Abraham Accords was about regional integration economically and militarily. It was about getting money from the Gulf to flow into the Zionist entity, but also the militaries in the region to become openly integrated and working together. And that was, you know, one of the key stipulations of the Abraham Accords is that the countries which sign onto it have to invest. I mean, in the cases of some of the Gulf countries, it looks like about $10 billion in the Israeli economy over many, many years. Now, that's pretty incredible. Mm. What would be the kind of stipulations placed on a tiny mini-state like Somaliland? Mm. So really, the Abraham Accords has been a subterfuge through which this empire that we're talking about has been expanded and extended, and Somaliland would be no different.
Right,
sure.
Right, okay. Well, so, I mean, David, I mean, it seems, doesn't it? It certainly looks as if that, you know, the Zionist entity and the UAE, I mean, they're using Somaliland as a sort of a gateway into Africa.
Look, it's a gateway into Africa. As I've said, it's about power projection, the military power projection, both ways, back to West Asia and Yemen, into the rest of Africa. But it's also about resource extraction. So as we saw in the show the other week about Sudan, the UAE has been involved in smuggling gold out of the Sudan. And, of course, that's part of that's going through Ethiopia, through Somaliland, and then up to the UAE. So, and clearly the Zionists are involved in that. We've previously done shows on the extraction of diamonds from the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Mm. Israel is one of the biggest exporters of diamonds, doesn't produce any diamonds itself. No, so it's about resource extraction, but it's also about the sinews of a proto-empire coming together. So we did a show just the other week on Taiwan. Like, the Taiwanese have a big presence in Somaliland, and that's about integrating resource extraction into the semiconductor industry in Taiwan, which, of course, is being benefited from by Israeli companies who have contracts there. So it's a quite a complex emergent empire which is coming about there. Mm.
And you also have to remember that Somaliland, for example, is a rich source of gemstones, the emeralds, rubies, also a rich source of lithium, which is vitally important to the big tech world, and Israel is a major player there.
Yes, indeed. I mean, David's saying they're, you know, incredibly complex and certainly tangled sort of web, low-key. But, I mean, the UAE appears to be using Somaliland as a bridge to Ethiopia, doesn't it? And onto its, indeed, its involvement in the massacres in Sudan.
Well, if you look across the region, and satellite imaging has revealed the extent of UAE construction in the region, a literal network of bases around the Bab el-Mandeb and around the Red Sea. Socotra, for example, which it's believed Israeli presence is there too, very, very close, and a good vantage point through which to hit the Yemeni forces. So the UAE has been accused of supplying the RSF in Sudan through all of these bases in the area. And it is really would be in line with history to see Israel having a direct role with the UAE on those bases, probably aiding the war in Sudan. You also have to remember why Sudan is so important, because historically you had an underground base there which was discovered, and the allegation was is that the underground base existed for the sole purpose of aiding the resistance in Gaza. So there was weapons manufacturing happening under the ground in Sudan, which was then going up, going through Egypt, and then going into Gaza. That is what the allegation is. Mm. Now, if that is the case, then you can very clearly see how important strategically Sudan is to the continuation, really, of Zionism in Gaza alone, let alone the rest of the region.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, I'm afraid our next report now highlights the catalogue of aggressive actions of the Zionist regime against nations bordering the Red Sea and the Horn of Africa.
The countries bordering the Red Sea and the Horn of Africa have all been under assault by the Zionist regime. In 1986, the Mossad embarked on a secret mission to bring Ethiopian Jews to Israel via Djibouti. But things went terribly wrong. Today, Djibouti is opposed to normalization with Zionism and to the genocide. It now hosts the only Chinese overseas base in the hemisphere. Zionist-Eritrean cooperation dates back to the mid-1990s. The Zionist regime has established a military base on the Dahlak Archipelago, 43 kilometers from the Eritrean coast. the second largest naval base outside its borders and one of the most advanced intelligence centers in the Horn of Africa, overlooking the Red Sea. Surveillance towers on top of the island's mountains are used by the Zionist Air Force for targeting. Israel has launched operations on Sudan from here. In recent years, however, Eritrea has reportedly pivoted towards Russia, China, and Iran. Israel and Ethiopia maintain close security relations. In November 2020, the Ethiopian National Intelligence and Security Service signed an agreement with Mossad to enhance intelligence and counterterrorism cooperation. In 2021, in a joint operation, 16 suspects were arrested in Addis Ababa, planning attacks on UAE embassies in Ethiopia and Sudan. Military cooperation has expanded in recent years, with the provision of military support, training, and equipment to Ethiopia. Ethiopia recently signed an agreement with Somaliland to lease a naval base in the port of Berbera. Socotra is a small archipelago of islands just off the coast of Yemen, which the UAE invaded and occupied in 2018. Recent reports suggest an Israeli desire to build a military and intelligence facility there. Construction is reportedly already underway on Abdel Kuri Island, part of Socotra, where a port, runway, and helicopter landing pad have been built. The UAE is not just a totalitarian state, but part of a new imperial axis with the Zionist state. This UAE-Israel axis sometimes acts as a satellite of U.S. power, but now also pursues its own expansionist interests. As in Socotra, or power projection bases such as South Sudan and Somaliland. The ideological base of the UAE-Israel axis is Zionist Islamophobia, combined with totalitarian hyper-neoliberalism. This ideology is in accord with U.S. imperial interests, but the UAE-Israel axis does not trust the U.S. and seeks independence from it, hence the debate on the Zionist right about whether the State of Israel should continue to accept U.S. aid. Part of the reason some anti-imperialists still cling to outdated ideas of the Zionist project and Persian Gulf states as simple U.S. satellites is this major blind spot about the importance of the UAE-Israel relationship and how its black ops are changing the world around us, from Europe to Africa to India.
Well, David, I mean, Djibouti and Eritrea have a long experience, don't they, of Zionist involvement in their countries.
Yeah, I mean, the Djibouti example is a nice one, isn't it? Because there was a Mossad operation there. They were trying to smuggle out and kidnap Ethiopian Jews to bring them to the colony to be settlers sure. there to challenge their demographic problem. And, of course, it all went wrong, and several of them were killed. There was all sorts of attacks on them. And in part, I think that's led to the way in which Djibouti now orients so such that it's got the first and only Chinese base in the hemisphere. I think, in fact, the only Chinese military base outside China in Djibouti. And the same really looks to be happening potentially in Eritrea since 2020. Although there's that base is really based there, the Eritreans have turned against the Zionist entity. They've even severed diplomatic relations. They've made statements about the genocide. So it's looking like there's a kind of pushback, and that's the sign that there can be pushback against the Zionist overreach in the region.
Yeah. I mean, locally, in the first segment, we talked, didn't we, about the UAE's involvement with Ethiopia. But, I mean, Ethiopia's developed close relations with the Zionist entity as well, hasn't it?
Well, it's not so much a question of developing close relations, it's those close relations have almost always existed.
Right.
Ethiopia, around 200,000 Ethiopians are Israeli citizens at least,